Welcome to the Double Loop Podcast, your source for everything about fingerprints. While you're working on your comparisons, we'll talk about comparisons. I'm Eric Ray.
And I'm Glenn Langenberg.
Well, Glenn, boy, we have been on a roll recently. I'm very proud of us for starting off this new year on the right foot and putting out, we're going to soon surpass the number of episodes we put out last year.
Combined, maybe the last couple of years.
Yeah, no, it's the resurgence. We've entered our second decade, Glenn.
Yes. Well, and I also blame and thank this trip to Australia because it was, as we've said before in previous episodes, just a bounty of presentations and great speakers. And today we have yet another speaker from that conference we'll get to in a little bit.
But first of all, I want to say thanks to all of our patrons on patreon.com that, you know, help us out with a dollar here or there to keep the all the files hosted and our website running. And so if you're interested in supporting us that way and getting access to all of our older episodes that are no longer on the main feed, you know, head over there and, you know, consider sending us a buck or two for keeping this all going.
Yeah, we put it to good use. It definitely helps with all the things in the background that you guys don't think about, like website hosting and being able to broadcast the podcast from various websites and all the little behind-the-scenes technology that you probably don't think about, but Eric and I are very cognizant of.
Absolutely. So, Glenn, with that, what quiz do you have for me here today?
Right. We have yet another installment of Where in the World? First of all, this country has the largest pyramid in the world.
Okay.
It has no official language. It has the largest expat population in the world, meaning a lot of people from other countries go there and live and retire. It has a region with a large river going through it, known as the Riviera. It has the meteor, theoretically, believed by archaeologists, the meteor that killed the dinosaurs struck here. The first printing press in the Western Hemisphere was here.
Interesting.
And then finally, they don't necessarily get gifts on Christmas Day. They do celebrate Christmas, but they don't get gifts on Christmas Day. Gifts are traditionally given on January 6th, also known as Three Kings Day. What country is this?
Yes, Epiphany, Three Kings Day. I'm going to go with Mexico.
You are correct, sir. Well done.
Yeah,
well done.
The pyramid was kind of aiming me in that direction, but then obviously the meteor was really what cinched it as absolutely that one.
I always thought the meteor was in Russia.
Oh no, that's the was it Tendusky or? I can't remember what it is. That's the one that exploded in the atmosphere and like leveled the whole forest. But it's funny. I remember as a kid learning about the meteor hitting there, and I was familiar with, you know, maps and stuff, and I'd seen maps and thought, oh, you know, yeah, Mexico has that kind of, you know, the Gulf of Mexico kind of has a little circle part, you know, that I'm like, I had thought that that's kind of the Gulf of Mexico was the leftover crater. It wasn't until later I saw, you know, an overlay map of where it actually hit and was like, oh, that, I mean, close, but not quite what I had pictured as a kid.
Yeah, I was thinking about Mexico today for two reasons. One, I had to call my verifier on a case because she might have to come and testify. And when she answered, she's like, hey, I'm in Mexico right now. I'm in Cancun going to the Riviera. I'm like, yeah, well, sorry to bug you, but. and then also in relationship to today, we talked about one of the other previous episodes about how this IAFS conference moves around. And one of the bidding cities was actually Mexico City. A lot of people would have liked to have seen it go to Mexico City. I've actually never been to Mexico City. That would have been pretty cool. But again, as I said in a previous episode, it landed in Bulgaria. So anyway. Mexico on the brain.
When I was in high school, my high school Spanish teacher would organize trips to Mexico. So I went on a couple of those first trip outside the country. So the way that trip worked was everyone loaded up onto a bus in Phoenix, and we also, so all of our luggage and everything, but then also we filled the bus, like the whole bathroom was filled up to the ceiling, and then the aisle was filled up to like, you know, armrest high, the entire length of the bus with like clothes and toys and things to bring down to donate to the poor villages outside of the city we were going to. So then drive down to Nogales, which is on the border, and then switch from the American bus to the Mexican bus by just picking everything up and walking across the border, dropping it off in the Mexican parking lot, circling back around through customs, now with empty hands, picking up another load and going back through, which they don't check you going in, at least back in the 90s. You know, there's, it's just a revolving door to get into Mexico, but then customs to come back. You do that about 10 times and then load up on the bus. And then we drove all the way down to Mazatlan.
Wow.
Which is, if you look on a map, that's a, it's a bit of a drive from Phoenix.
Wow.
So anyway, that was, you know, first couple trips internationally were on a bus halfway across Mexico.
Yeah, we went to Ohio for our high school trips. 2 hours down the road in Ohio.
And one of the trips, I was there during the Oklahoma City bombing. So it was weird just kind of coming back into the U.S. and everyone else had been like up to speed on all the news and everything. And we didn't know what was going on.
So. No, sure. Right.
Anyway.
Anyway.
Let's move on. I think you said you had an email for us to talk about.
I do. We got an email from Philip from Canada, oh, Canada. And he wanted to let us know that he really enjoyed the Caitlin Ruff podcast, the one about the faux blood prints, blood prints at crime scenes and processing blood prints and so forth at crime scenes. He really enjoyed that. Philip is a bit of a bloodstain buff, if you will, and really enjoys the interaction of blood and latent prints and those two fields. So anyway, he really enjoyed that episode, and he also shared that he was at a scene a few months back, located a bloody palm impression on a bathtub with leucocrystal violets. And they were thinking about stopping with that, but he wanted to do a little bit more work and applied Hungarian red as well, which ended up resulting in some more detail being developed that was not developed with the leucocrystal violet. And so just another thing that we even talked about in the episode, the importance of processing with dye stains. Some crime scene techs are content to just photograph bloody ridge detail if it's relatively clear and not even try a dye stain. Not only did he try a dye stain, but he tried a second dye stain at the scene, which kudos to that. And sounds like he was able to pretty much help solve a case because they ended up getting a hit on this case and were able to really provide important evidence in the case.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like seeing a bloody print is just the start and this kind of the clue that there's probably more nearby if you just process with something.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, and glad we can touch on a topic that, you know, that speaks to our listeners. So yeah, keep on listening.
And on that note, I'm very excited to introduce our guest today, all the way from Australia again. We have a guest. Her name is Chloe George. She has been with New South Wales Police for just a little bit over a year, moving on a year and a half. And she originally attended University of Technology Sydney, UTS, and was a master's student there. And she presented at the IAFS conference, and I saw her presentation. I was blown away by it. It was fantastic. And I've got a couple of little stories I'll tell, too, as she comes on and talks about the presentation. But, Eric, it really, I just sat there stunned and just so enjoyed not only the content of the presentation, but she herself was a very entertaining, dynamic speaker. And it was just fun to watch a newbie get up there and just knock it out of the park. So it's very enjoyable. And with that, we're going to welcome on Chloe. Hi, Chloe.
Hello.
Welcome,
thank
Chloe.
You for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Absolutely. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, Glenn and I were talking last night, and you know, he gave me a heads up that I might really enjoy this this episode, just harkening back to the old paper I did on palm prints back in the day, and had some similar properties of what we're going to discuss here with phalanges. So.
Yeah, I referenced your paper in my thesis, actually. So
that's awesome.
I am very aware of that paper. It's fantastic.
That's very great. Cool. That's really great. So yeah, you've been thoroughly hyped up. So
okay.
Yeah, excited to get into this here today. So
yeah, you better deliver, Chloe.
On the pressure.
So yeah, introduce yourself to the audience.
Yeah, so I am currently a civilian or an unsworn crime scene officer attached to the Fingerprint Operations Branch with New South Wales Police Force. As Glenn said, I've been working here since about mid to 2022, where I guess I'm just honing my skills to become a fingerprint expert in the near future.
And you work with our buddy, Michael White, Whitey.
I do work with Whitey. Yeah, he's in training and research, and he's been a fantastic help, especially when I first started.
Yeah, he's the fantastic. Best.
Yeah, he's great.
Well, to start off, you know, our just traditional question for most of our guests, you know, how did you end up falling into fingerprints?
I had a bit of an interesting or unique pathway, I guess you could say, into forensic science.
Sure.
I actually began my university career, I guess, doing a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts at Sydney Uni. So I didn't really know what I wanted to do at the time, but I was taking subjects that really interested me and that I enjoyed. And so I somehow ended up with three majors in anatomy, archaeology, and ancient history, obviously none of which really correlate to forensic science. But during these 4 years at uni, I did a subject called forensic osteology, and I just absolutely loved it. And I knew that I wanted to keep studying following my undergraduate degrees, and I wanted to do a master's degree. And while I would have loved to have done forensic anthropology, there just weren't many jobs available. It's kind of few and far between in Australia. So I kind of just settled on forensics. And so following my undergraduate degrees, I enrolled at the University of Technology, Sydney, doing a master's in forensic science. And I'd heard UTS had a fantastic forensic science program, so I knew I was in good hands.
Indeed.
Yeah. And so I really enjoyed it. And that's what led me to my job as a crime scene officer today.
And in going through that forensic program, I mean, there's lots of different things you could do within forensics. Was there anything specific that drove you to fingerprints as opposed to DNA or toxicology or any of the other fields?
Yeah, well, with a master's degree, you don't actually choose a major. So you do kind of get to dabble in a bit of everything, which I did really enjoy. I think it was my research project that we'll talk about later that really drove me into fingerprints. I really loved my year at doing research, and that's, I guess, what led me here today.
All right, fantastic. Let's then segue right to that. What was the presentation that you were sharing at the conference that Glenn saw?
Yes, the presentation I gave at IAFS was kind of a general summary of the research project that I did as part of my Master's of Forensic Science degree at UTS. So my research project examined the ridge flow on the medial and the proximal phalanges of the fingers.
Now, you'll need to clarify for our lay folks in the audience. And maybe even some fingerprint examiners not always familiar with the anatomical description. So let's be a little more vernacular about what we're talking about here.
Yeah, definitely. So I think we are all pretty well acquainted with what we call the distal phalanges, which we kind of generically refer to as a fingerprint, which is the fingertip. But on all four of our fingers, we have three phalanges. On the thumb, we only have two. And we have the distal, the medial, and the proximal phalanges. And so when I'm talking about medial and proximal phalanges, I'm referring to the friction ridge skin over the phalanges.
Right. So a lot of people, especially lay people, will look at their fingers and go, well, those are my finger joints. Mm-hmm. And anatomically, no, the joints are actually effectively where the creases are and where the finger bends. But the section in between the joints is what we call phalanges, and they have very distinctive ridge flow, how the ridges flow through that area, which of course also will dictate and structure how the ridge minutiae will also line along the flow of those ridges. So that's the area that we're talking about, what lay people might think of as finger joints, but that's the phalanges.
Yes.
And this will be a very visual description of your talk, Chloe. So just to let listeners know ahead of time, we're going to include on the website and with the episode, we'll have links below that will be able to take the listener to view slides from the presentation. And so before we even get into it, if there's anyone who's at their computer who wants to do that right now, we highly recommend it. Because we're going to be trying to describe these things, but really, here, a picture is worth a thousand words.
100%. I'll try my best. It is, as Glenn said, a very visual presentation, but I will try my best to describe it to you guys.
So looking at your presentation here, Chloe, the first couple slides, talk about how the ridge flow on, on this phalange has not been studied a whole lot. And it looks like you wanted to start with a review of the literature. So just off the top of my head, I wouldn't really know where to start with the ridge flow of that part of the finger. So, where did you find existing research?
So a lot of my research actually came from coursework kind of provided to New South Wales Police, I believe from Ron Smith. He had a course that was entitled Demystifying Palm Prints. And in that, he gives a bit of a description on phalange ridge flow. And so mm-hmm. what we kind of know is that there's that, we call it down and out ridge flow on the outer fingers. So specifically the index and the little finger. And then on the inner fingers, so the middle and the ring, we see more of a wavy ridge flow. But that's pretty much the only consistencies that have been noted in the literature. A lot of what is mentioned is largely anecdotal and not based on empirical research. But right. that's what we know.
Right. That's about all I knew about the ridge flow. And there is one other rule that I had learned in Ron's class as well, which was the middle finger and the ring finger. If you look at the top of the medial phalange, the ridges will tend to be flatter, straighter, more horizontal in that area, whereas they will have a little bit more down and out flow in, like you said, on the exterior fingers. And that particular area is very distinctive, like right below the middle and the ring finger. But yeah, other than that, boy, that's about all I ever learned.
Yeah, we can also use the creases as well, because we've got type 1 and type 2 creases between the phalanges. But apart from that, that's all we knew. Yeah.
Yeah.
And by type 1 and type 2, you mean having that kind of double crease?
Correct.
When, in the impression or versus just a single line?
Yes, correct. Exactly. Yeah.
But you found another source that nobody knew about. And talk us through that a little bit, because when it came to that point in the presentation and you said, but I found this other resource, I looked over to Christoph, who was sitting next to me, and was like, Christoph, have you ever heard of this? And he looked at me and he shook his head like, I've never heard of this. And if Christoph has never heard of something, this is a real find. So please talk us through this most amazing find that you have.
Yeah, it was, I think, luck of the draw kind of thing, I would say. So I was doing my initial research, so my initial kind of literature review for my thesis. And I was trawling through article after article, just going kind of down a rabbit hole of research. And that's when I happened upon this particular article by a German anthropologist, the name of Marie Plowitz-Radmann. It was all in German, so I had to use Google Translate to assist in translating the article into English. And yeah, she was a German anthropologist who published her study in 1937, classifying the medial and the proximal phalange.
Yeah, I'm going to take a stab here at this. What is that?
Go ahead.
Die Hautleiste müsste der unteren beiden Fingerglieder der menschlichen Hand.
I mean, that sounded really good. What that translates to roughly is skin-rich patterns of the lower two phalanges of the human hand.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Well, again, going back to the palm paper I did, seems like a lifetime ago. Towards the end of, after I'd done my whole thing of gathering data and worked up almost all my paper, I stumbled upon a German publication, not quite back to the 30s, but still that talked about ridge flow and patterns in the palms, and did the same thing, Google Translate to figure out what they were talking about. Now, one of the things that I noticed in going through that paper was I had to kind of figure out, because they would use colloquial terms.
Right.
Which kind of is what we do too, like, loop or arch, or if you think about it, are just regular words that we've kind of tacked on to these specific patterns. So Google Translate did its best, but I had to kind of figure out what some of these words were talking about. Did you have a similar experience?
I definitely had a very similar experience. I was lucky though. There are population studies that used Plowitz-Radmann's research, and most of them were actually in English. So any difficulties I had in translation with Plowitz-Radmann were kind of solved with these other English papers.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the Plowitz-Radmann system mm-hmm. allowed you to effectively classify
yes.
the phalanges. There was a system for classification.
Yes.
And there were names for these different sort of ridge flows. And that's what I think was so shocking. Can you walk us through some of those different classifications?
Yeah, definitely. So she had 12 general pattern types, and she distinguished them between, she had 4 basic and 8 combination pattern types. So a basic type was something she referred to as, or any pattern that she referred to as having continuous flow of ridges, whereas a combination was one that didn't have a continuous flow of ridges, or as she described it, where 2 strips of ridges would kind of clash. So I can take you through each pattern yes. type if you'd like.
Yes. Yes, and we'll try to describe best as possible each one of these here.
Yeah, definitely. So the first pattern type, which she described as one of her basic pattern types, was called the stripe. So this is a group of straight parallel ridges that can either flow across the flange diagonally or horizontally. And then we've got the hook type pattern, which is very similar to a stripe, except the ridges will start or end with a small curve or a hook.
Yeah, almost like an arch almost.
Yeah, very similar.
But off to one side or the other of the finger, yeah. It looks like.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Good point.
And then we've got the third pattern type, which is the bow. And this is where ridges form a curve or an arch horizontally across the phalange.
Right.
And it looks like that can either be like an arch or upside down, so more smiley face.
It could go either way, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. We then have the wave, which, as it sounds, consists of 2 arcs joined together, and this would typically flow horizontally across the phalange as well.
Right, like one up, one down, like a sinusoidal wave.
Exactly, yeah. We then go into what she referred to as the combination pattern types, the first of which is the angle, and this is where 2 directions of ridges meet in an angle. So you'll have one set of ridges that run parallel to the finger creases or horizontally, and then the other set will run diagonally.
Yeah, and almost create like a delta kind of almost.
Yeah, it's almost like diverging type lines that are going to be a delta eventually if it keeps going far enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I remember someone showing me this pattern that actually did form a delta. It was.
Right. In the phalange. I saw that too, Eric. I'd never seen a delta before in a phalange, but you're right. There was one. Yeah, it was like a loop and a delta thing.
I'm going to say it was someone here in Arizona that showed it to me. Not like in casework or anything, but. It was just so rare that it has to be like a friend of a friend. And then, you know. But anyway, sorry, keep going.
It's all right. I think the next one I was up to was the arc angle, which is very similar to an angle, except the ridges that run parallel to the creases will actually form a curve or an arc. So the horizontal ridges will form that curve that intersects with the diagonal ridges.
Yes. Yep, I can see that. That's pretty cool.
Almost like one of those arches. On a finger that, where it's like, it's kind of halfway in between an arch and a 1 count loop. But for most of these, they look like upside down.
Yeah, I could see that. So the next pattern would be the double angle. And this, as it sounds, is just a combination of 2 angles. So you'll have 2 strips of ridges that flow horizontally and 1 strip of ridges that flow diagonally across the phalange. And they'll all kind of intersect, kind of forming like a Z type.
Right, exactly. Or I was thinking like the less than greater than sign that you learn in mathematics.
Oh, yes.
And you've got both, you have both greater than and less than in the same finger.
Exactly.
Yeah, perfect.
And we then have the double arc angle, which as it sounds, is just a combination of 2 arc angles together. So very similar to a double angle, but it has 2 arc angles rather than 2 angles.
Yeah, that one's cool. I like that. Yeah,
it is pretty cool, yeah.
I can see some of these being difficult to classify if you didn't have a full capture.
Yes, definitely. I think that was one of the limitations to my study. Some of the phalange that I have didn't capture the full phalange. Obviously, they're not rolls. They're just slats. So some of them were difficult to capture. But a lot of them, as you can see in this slide, you can tell that it's a double arc angle.
Yeah.
You can see those arcs. We then have the double sheet, which is where 2 arcs or curves meet back to back. And this often happens in the approximate midline of the phalange. So it's almost like 2 bows back to back.
Yeah, it reminds me of upside down horseshoe and an upright horseshoe meeting together like in the curved areas. Or if you're into astrology, it's a sign for Pisces.
Oh, there you go.
Or 2 parentheses facing, the wrong way, being open at both ends.
Yes, right. Yeah, excellent.
The next pattern would be the inclusion type pattern, and this typically contained a spindle-shaped core, and this could be either completely enclosed or open to the left or the right side.
Yeah, I could see myself confusing this one for like one of the arc angle.
Yeah, that's fair. I think once you see a fair few, you do get used to what an inclusion type pattern would look like and what the angles or the arc angles look like.
It almost looks like you have to have this sort of recurving center to it.
Yeah, it was very unique.
Yeah, it's cool. Okay.
The next pattern is the feather type pattern. And this was an arrangement of acute to obtuse angles that flow horizontally across the phalange.
Yeah.
And I didn't encounter any of these in my research, unfortunately, which I thought they looked pretty cool, but I didn't see a single one, unfortunately.
I'm not sure if I've ever seen it. At least the example you have here in the presentation, I don't think I've ever seen something that pronounced.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it's like a series of greater than signs just eating each other in a row.
It's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Yep.
And finally, the 12th pattern is a rare type pattern. So this is just any pattern that couldn't be classified into the previous 11 patterns. Yeah.
Are these samples here, are they from the German paper? Or are they from your samples?
They're a bit of both, actually. So the ones typically on the left were from my own research. And the ones typically on the right, if anyone's looking at the presentation, were from Plowitz-Ratman's research.
Which is why for the feather, there was only the one image.
Correct.
There.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, the one there on the for the rare, I mean, I'd want to see more samples of that finger, but it almost looks like a scar.
That was my thought.
It's hard to tell.
Yeah.
If it's a scar or the natural ridge flow.
Agreed. And I think that's why I classified this particular example as a rare, because I couldn't tell if it was scar or it was just a random pattern.
Yeah. Well, all right. So I assume then next thing would be talking about the frequencies of these.
Yeah, definitely. So I had a few different aims to my research. So I wanted to not only look at the frequency and distribution of patterns found on the flange, but I also wanted to look to see if there were any trends in the direction of ridges. So I can talk about the population frequencies to start, if that suits you guys.
Yes.
Yeah. So in terms of population frequencies for patterns, we found that the hook was by far the most frequent pattern type at almost 30% of all patterns.
And that's like the asymmetric arch that you saw.
Exactly. And then this was followed by the angle, which was at about 18%. And then the stripe, which was about 16% of all patterns. We also found that the wave and the double arc angle were rarely observed at only about 2% for each pattern.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, if we moved on to the frequency and distribution of patterns on individual fingers, we found that double arc angles didn't occur on the thumbs or the little fingers at all, not a single one. We also found that double angles weren't found on the thumbs at all either.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Bows tended to be more characteristic of the middle and the ring fingers. We see them at much higher frequencies there. And when we have a look at the thumbs and the little fingers specifically, there was a much less variety of patterns, and we typically saw more angles, hooks, and stripes.
Yeah, so there's a slide in the presentation, it's slide 29. If anyone is able to access this and they want to study, like I would just spend hours probably studying just this slide right here. I mean, it's got so much good data in it, just these couple of slides.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot to go through. I definitely found that when I was kind of trawling through all these statistics, was like, what is more significant? What showed, you know, really interesting trends? It's definitely difficult when there's a lot going on.
Mm-hmm, indeed. All right, next.
So I also wanted to have a look at the frequency and distributions of patterns on the phalange specifically. So when we had a look at just the medial phalanges, we found quite significant trends. So we found that 100% of all double arc angle patterns observed were found on the medial phalanges alone, which is obviously quite significant.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we found that 92% of double angle patterns occurred on the medial phalange, 91% of arc angles, and 85% of all angle type patterns occurred on the medial phalange in a much higher frequency than what we found on the proximal phalange. So it was really interesting to see that these are all angle type patterns and they're all occurring with a much higher frequency on the medial phalange over the proximal phalange.
Yeah, it's interesting because as I look at the images you have there, and again, for our listeners, we're talking about effectively your middle segment of your finger. That's the medial phalange. And it's almost like you've got ridges being pulled in multiple directions. And I'm thinking about, of course, the biology here of, you know, how these things form. You've got these pads that are forming, you know, on your paddle-like fingers. And then as these pads are receding, that's when your ridges begin to appear in the timing of things. So you would have to have effectively, to create this, you'd have to have almost multiple volar pads on your medial phalange, and they'd have to be receding to create this effect almost near the end of the recession, but because that would create the counter ridges flowing against them, because that's the ridges between the pads. So I'm just kind of thinking about how this plays out from a volar pad structure.
Well, usually you think of the volar pads on the distal phalange, mm-hmm. but still the proliferation, you know, starts in general from the nail, the center, and the crease. Yeah. So if we were to kind of just move that down to the medial and proximal phalange, I would at least assume that it starts from the crease. And then here with the medial one, if it is expanding out from the crease above and the crease below, and they're merging there in the middle, you know, that I can visualize that, you know, here in these examples, where you've got right about the center, this kind of differing direction of ridge flow also abruptly changes there in the middle.
Right, because they're meeting in the middle, they're like waves crashing into each other, they're coming at different angles, as opposed to starting in the, I was thinking starting in the center if you had pads here, but you're right, if it was coming from the creases, from the joints, and merging towards the middle, I could see that, although there still would have to be something causing some of the directionality there. It's interesting. Chloe, did that ever come up, like any of the hand structure and how that might affect some of these patterns?
No, unfortunately. Even in all the population studies, no one really mentioned anything about what may have caused it and how they are formed in the womb. So yeah, something maybe someone could do future research on, but it is interesting to think about.
Yeah, we'd have to, I mean, it would almost be impossible today, but back in the 70s when they would do embryo studies, you'd almost have to get aborted fetuses to look at that moment in time, what does the phalange look like? Is there a volar pad? Are there multiple volar pads? Where are the ridges beginning to start? That's all work that William Babler did for the distal phalange, for the fingertip.
Right.
But yeah, we haven't really seen that kind of work done in the phalange. I don't know anyone that's done that, but that's interesting. Yeah, it's a good thought, Eric.
Yeah.
And then what about the proximal phalanges?
Yeah, so the proximal phalanges also showed some significant trends. So first of all, we found that almost 90% of all combination type patterns. So a combination pattern for anyone who's not looking at my slides was either a double sheet, an inclusion, a feather pattern, or a rare pattern. So I combined these four patterns into one, which I did term the compound or combination pattern. And I did this because all the studies before me noted that they were quite rare and seldom observed. So I combined them into one for my study. And when we look at the proximal phalange, we found that 87% of all these type patterns occurred more frequently here than on the medial phalange. This was the same also for the stripe, the wave, and the hook type patterns which all occurred at much higher frequencies on the proximal phalange over the medial phalange.
Yeah.
I can move on to ridge direction trends now, if you like.
Yeah, so
Eric's doing the same thing that I was doing in your presentation, like, but wait, I want to see more of that slide.
There is a lot going on, I must say.
I'm also resisting asking more questions like, well, what about left versus right hands? What about outside versus inside fingers? And I, you know, I know that they're coming here in the next slide, so I'm trying to hold my tongue.
I was conscious of the fact that when I designed this presentation, it was to fit into a 12-minute time frame. But I do think I could talk about these trends for well over half an hour. But yeah, there is a lot to look at, definitely, especially with these tables. There's a lot of numbers, a lot going on.
Yeah. All right. Well, walk us through some of the ridge direction trends.
Yeah. So in terms of ridge direction trends, we found that the thumbs and the index fingers had a distinctly radial trend, whereas the little fingers and the left ring finger had a distinctly ulnar trend. So the right ring and the middle fingers showed a much greater variability with directions. And so this does follow through with that down and out ridge flow that we see on the outer fingers and more of that kind of variety of directions within the inner fingers.
Interesting, though, the left ring and not the right ring kind of jumped in with the little fingers.
Yeah, it was interesting to see, definitely.
That's
I don't know what to make of that.
Neither, to be honest.
I mean, just going back to my old palm study where, you know, I found vestiges either on the left hand or on both hands, but virtually never on just the right. And you know, wondering if it's just this overall trend in humans to be right-handed, and if that is, you know, also seen during development of, you know, how the fetus is positioning the hand and just being open versus closed, and the amount of time mm-hmm. it's open versus closed, or when that coincides with proliferation, if that's affecting things.
Yeah. I did read one study that spoke about maybe this down and out ridge flow that we see. So the radial trend on the thumbs and index and the ulnar trend on the little fingers and the left ring kind of equated to like a grip to help with grip.
Mm.
Don't really know what to believe there, but it was an interesting theory for sure.
Sure.
The left ring being an ulnar trend could come down to the fact that there was slight trends when we look at like a bimanual comparison. So for the left hand, 54% of directions were ulnar oriented, whereas only 30% of directions were radially oriented for the left hand.
Hmm.
And then when we had a look at the right hand, we found that there was a slight radial direction trend where 56%, preference, 56% of all directions were radially oriented, whereas only 31% were ulnar oriented. So there's that slight ulnar trend in the left hand and a slight radial trend in the right hand.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. When we had a look at the thumbs and the little fingers distinctly, we found quite significant trends. So for the left thumb in particular, 96% were radially oriented. And for the right thumb, 100% were radially oriented. And then the little finger, conversely, 100% of the left little finger was ulnar oriented, and 99% of the right little finger was ulnar oriented. So quite significant trends there with the thumbs and the little fingers.
For sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that fits with some of the clues that we've learned as well.
Right. The down and out, whether, right. you know, towards the outside of the hand. So the little finger side on the little finger and the index finger side on the index finger or thumb.
For our lay listeners, ulnar refers towards directionality towards your little finger, radial towards yes. your
yep.
thumb.
Correct. Yeah.
A little anatomy lesson.
And again, for the lay listeners, in general, the patterns on the distal flanges, the actual fingerprints, tend to be ulnar oriented, where the ridge flow is in that direction.
Right.
So, Chloe, did you take a look at all on how the patterns in the phalanges related to the patterns on the distal flange?
I did. I did have a look at the relationship between all phalange, so the distal, medial, and proximal. Unfortunately, no relationship was found between the pattern observed on the distal phalange, so either it being a loop, an arch, or a whorl, and then the patterns on the proximal medial phalange. So we created bar charts that show the counts of how many times a particular phalange pattern was observed when the distal phalange was either a loop, arch, or whorl. But the results of these bar charts appear to just be a reflection of the frequency of the phalangeal patterns overall.
Eric, that's actually a great question. And that's a really interesting finding, that the finger pattern and the phalange patterns are not correlated. I'm a little surprised by that.
Yeah. And what about in the finger pattern, the index finger is the most likely to have a radial loop. But, you know, looking at the direction trends, it doesn't even seem that there's, I mean, most of the, for the index fingers, they seem to be mostly radial direction oriented anyway, you know, very few, if any, towards the ulnar side. So that'd be the kind of the one, if any of them right. were to show a different preference than the other fingers, I would be looking at the index first. So, you know, even direction wise, there doesn't seem to be a relation.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, the relationship between all phalange wasn't a focus of mine. My focus was to look at overall trends. And sure. I did have a lot of help with my supervisor, Xanthi Spindler, who's fantastic. Thank you, Xanthi. And also—
Shout out to Xanthi.
Yeah, shout out to Xanthi. And also help from Dr. Anjali Gupta. She works at UTS as well, and she helped with a lot of the stats side of things, and she helped sure. with calculating these bar charts and looking at it. And yeah, unfortunately, we did find that the charts just appeared to be a reflection of frequency, like pattern frequency overall.
Interesting. Yeah, that really is. Would have thought there'd be some relationship there, but no.
Is it because, you know, maybe the hand is flexing so much? I mean, whenever I see the fetal hand, I mean, it's always kind of scrunched in. Where is that creating pressure or random pressures on those phalanges in some way. I mean, I really am curious about the biology here, and I hope Alice White gets a chance to listen to this episode, and I wonder if she has thoughts or has found something in the literature regarding the embryonic development in the phalange.
Yeah, I would love to know the reason or potential reasons for why these trends are the way that they are. It would be really interesting to know. If anyone knows anything, by all means.
Yeah, it really is interesting. Mm. I almost would have anticipated some sort of relationship to pattern.
Yeah, I definitely think future studies could focus more on this aim and definitely delve a little bit deeper than I did. But overall, at first glance, it doesn't appear to be in a relationship.
But you did find a relationship to finger number, right? There was a relationship with some of the patterns to certain fingers.
Yes. Yeah, there was.
That's interesting because we know that some of the pattern, like fingerprint patterns, have relationships to certain fingers.
Yeah.
But yet still no tie from the pattern down to the phalange.
Yeah.
You know, it may be, you know, this relationship of the, you know, to the finger is basically that finger position or the shape or, you know, the biology has kind of guided us to having this direction on this finger because it's towards the outside of the hand. But if the pattern, at least, you know, the prevailing theory of the pattern on the distal phalange is related to the timing of that volar pad regression compared to the ridge proliferation. But if that's only happening then on that part of the finger, then it's, and just, you know, more so how the proliferation happens on the joints, you know, being how that's determined, then it's kind of then seems to become then unrelated because maybe that's where this is going. Since it's separate, since the volar pad plays such a role in finger patterns, that's maybe why there's no relation here to the phalanges.
So then how do you now anticipate this information being used as it gets disseminated and as listeners get access to this? But my first question should be, you do plan to publish this, right?
Yes, definitely. I should have done it a long time ago, really, but I'm currently in the process of writing the article to publish. So hopefully in the
excellent
near future, you might see publication from me.
Yes. Okay. No doubt. That would be very useful. And I think listeners would like to get access to it in that manner. So that's good to hear. And now, how do you envision this information actually being used? Once it's published and it's out there, how does an examiner incorporate this information?
I saw two main operational uses. So the first is in regard to search heuristics, and the second in training fingerprint practitioners. So when I'm talking about search heuristics, I'm referring to finger and hand nomination. So if examiners can successfully use these phalange ridge flow trends when nominating a hand or a finger, then we can potentially perform narrower searches on aphis, which obviously increases the chances of finding a hit or a match.
Sure. So it makes you a more efficient searcher.
Yes, I would say so. It's like how we use finger and hand nomination for distal phalange. So if you've got like a right sloping loop, you're more inclined to search the right hand and the left index finger.
Yes, it's the search smart, not hard theory.
Yes, exactly. And so although at the moment, for us in Australia anyway, unfortunately phalange ridge flow isn't actively captured by our live scan machines. And if it is, it is captured by chance. But hopefully with next gen NAFIS, the capability for searching against phalange latents is possible in the near future. But at the moment, you can definitely use the results of this study in conjunction with distal phalange to narrow down a search. And then when, or in regards to training fingerprint practitioners, so a lack of training can obviously affect an examiner's ability in determining proper orientation of partial latent prints. So if examiners have knowledge of typical phalange ridge flow and these trends, this can hopefully not only help examiners locate and orientate a phalange impression from a crime scene, but also help in determining the anatomical source. So knowing it's come from a phalange rather than, say, a palm or a fingertip.
Do you think it informs at all how we also now look at the rarity of the characteristics? Even though examiners typically don't assign specific weights to level one detail, even though they probably should on really rare patterns on unusual finger numbers, do you see the same thing here, like particular unusual or rare ridge flow in the phalange could be considered by the examiner towards their identification decision?
Yeah, definitely. I think, yeah, we see that for distal phalange as well. Like if you get a, like say, Newton loop or something like that, that's obviously a little bit more rare than just a right sloping or a left sloping loop. So it could definitely help. Yeah.
Yeah, I have no doubt that I will be updating my slides in one of my classes, in my ACEV class, and you will absolutely be getting a credit and you will have a name on my slides. So yeah, this it's really great stuff that I look forward to teaching to fingerprint examiners.
I'm so glad people are so interested in my research. I honestly didn't expect to get this much recognition, especially IFS. It was really nice to see so many people interested in phalange, I guess.
Yeah, in fact, you perfect segue. We'll let listeners know that you won an award at IAPS. I believe it was the coolest presentation ever. I believe that was the name of the award.
Oh, if only. No, the name of the award was actually Best Oral.
Presentation. Best Oral Presentation.
Oh, well, it should have said Best Oral Presentation, but it said Best Oral. So that's hilarious. Yeah, I don't know how that got through, but it did. And I'll definitely be putting that on the resume.
That's great. So good.
I do have to say, though, that it was a very surprising award given I think we had 50-odd fingerprint presentations given over the course of 4 days, and some of them were phenomenal. So it was very surprising to see that I got that, but I'm very grateful for it.
It was well-deserved. It really was. It really was one of my favorite presentations. I was really lucky because the sections that I chaired and the sections that I watched had some of the best presenters. I mean, that's why we've had so many people on recently who have presented. We had Bethany Grounds. We had Caitlin Ruff. We had Andy Chapman. And might even have a couple more people from the conference as well here. So for me, it was just so shocking to have been in this field for 25 years and go, wait, what? There's a classification system for one-third of the hand that we use in our examinations?
It is crazy, isn't it, to think about that we just had no idea before.
Yes.
That all you have to do is just do a deep dive and you find just this unknown classification system that's been sitting there for 85 plus odd years.
Yeah, and it's not even just the classification system, it's the data as well. And I think that was pretty cool that the data that was done originally, but also again the data of course that you found in your in your work, that to me is what really is quite useful, because it allows me now again as an expert to start to recognize these patterns and start to assign some weight to the rarity and consider that in my decision making.
Yeah, definitely.
It just, for me, it just reemphasizes what I've said for a long time of fingerprints is absolutely the field to get into if you want to do some research and get something published, because there's so much out there that we can ask questions about and look for answers for. And for anyone out there listening, I hope this is inspirational to have your own questions. That's where my palm print thing came from, was, well, hearing Alice speak and saying, all right, just have a question, go count stuff, and then tell everyone else about it. And this follows that same kind of, philosophy of have a question and then just go count things and look how interested people are. There's so much opportunity for this kind of research from anyone out there in this field.
Yeah, if only, though, it used AI to disprove the uniqueness of fingerprints, I would actually be really impressed, if only.
I'm guessing you have also read the article that came out today. Was it today or yesterday?
Well, it came out for us a few days ago.
Okay. We've only just come across it today in the office, and it's been talk of the town at the moment, that's for sure. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, Glenn and I talked for 2 hours about it last night.
You did, yes.
That episode will come out before this one here, but we definitely spent some time with that one.
Yeah.
It's a good one to talk about, that's for sure.
What impact is it having on your office? What are you guys saying? Because we actually talked a little bit about the impact here, and we fully expect it to be asked about it in the courtroom, which is one of the points we made in the episode about sort of some of the dangers of miscommunicating and misrepresenting the extent of the research, which you have not done at all. You have been fantastic about the extent of your research. Any impact or fallout in your office regarding this?
Not as of yet, no. It was more just discussion among my own colleagues. We were just kind of talking about how it's almost like a clickbait. Like the article says, you know, disproving uniqueness. And that's not really actually what it says in the article at all. Yeah, it was definitely interesting to talk about.
Yeah, fantastic. You independently confirmed what Eric and I had also said. That's fantastic. That's...
Yeah, did you also believe it was clickbait too with the
We used exactly
heading?
Those words and summarized it exactly as you said, that it does not disprove uniqueness. And showed something different, showed that there could be similarity across neighboring fingers within the same source.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's it.
All right, Chloe, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing this. Again, just a great amount of research and data. And I can see this being a reference for many people for years to come. You know, the slide 33 is this great, you know, cartoons of the hands with the trends of ridge flow. I can see that getting tacked up on people's, you know, boards at their desk as a reference for flange comparisons down the road. So just thank you so much for coming on and sharing with all this with
thank
us
you.
And having this fantastic presentation at the conference.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. And I hope I've shown everyone that flange can indeed be classified into distinct patterns, which, you know, who knew?
Exactly.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, Glenn, what kind of classes do you have coming up?
Well, I have an in-person live class in Irvine, California. It is the Practical Answers for Challenging Questions in the Courtroom, the class I teach with the defense attorney, Brendan Max and Carrie Hall. That is May 6th through the 8th. And if students are interested, they can go to sign up at ronsmithandassociates.com.
All right. If you have any questions for us, you want to reach out on this topic or any other ones that we talk about, you can send us emails, eric@rayforensics.com or glenn@eliteforensicservices.com. I mentioned it before, but you can go to the webpage, doubleloop podcast.com, to see past episodes, look at our merchandise store, all sorts of good stuff there. The opinions expressed on the show are those of the speaker, not necessarily anyone that they work for. And with that, talk to you guys next time.
Bye, everybody. Have a great week.
Bye, everyone. Thank you.